And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Lise is right about America being the land of opportunity, and maybe Adil has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do, sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing is anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Dan Platt, live here in the studio. Here to normalize communism for you, just as Bernie Sanders has normalized socialism in that hopey, changey kind of way of at least getting people used to the word, just so that there's not that visceral reaction. Maybe if you're not a boomer, usually not. Let's see if we can do that again. So just give me a second. I am trying to set up live stream on Facebook. Then go to Three Left Show on Facebook and you can watch me do the show. So I'm going to talk about ecological issues again today. I'm going to start with a few shorter stories pertaining to the seas and ocean and oil drilling. So let's just dive into it because there's a lot to cover. I've stockpiled a lot of stories as always. The last two episodes, a few weeks, I've actually had guests on, which is new. Well, not completely new, but it's been a while. Went most of the winter not having guests. Kind of a individualist for a little bit. But I'm starting to realize just how toxic it is to do things. No, it's not a matter of doing things on your own. It's more about just thinking things need to go your way. Okay, so I don't want to blackpill you early. Blackpilling is the kind of, like redpilling, where you realize a truth about the world, or rather, the big picture, to change your mindset. Blackpilling is usually going into a nihilistic stupor about how hopeless the situation is. That is one side of a reaction to ecological news of any type. So many people ignore it or tune it out because they have enough to worry about personally. But I'm here to tell you, or explain, that your personal woes, being overworked, being depressed, being anxious, is tied into how we treat the environment, how we are destroying the world, how we are encouraging ecological collapse with our general civilization. And I'll cover a story that explains that. I'm actually going blind into it. Unfortunately, I've not reviewed everything that I'm going to read, but I have reviewed these two stories. So I can jump in after I'm reading here on your leftist reading hour for the week. This is from Tree Hugger. 3,000 dolphins found dead on the coast of Peru. Now, over the years, there have been many fish kills. Fish kill refers to when tens of thousands of fish just kind of wash up on shore dead, mysteriously. But with a little bit of investigation, it is seen that there are a cause for these massive die-offs of marine life, which might bring Soylent Green to your mind if you've ever seen that movie. It's the one where humanity is cannibalizing itself for the sake of keeping the hierarchy after we've destroyed all life on Earth, pretty much. The lie is that Soylent Green is made of marine life, plankton and kelp, which is a growing industry, I've read. We're on track to destroying all marine life. So, but here's just like a visceral example of dolphins. We all love dolphins. You know, we want dolphin safe tuna. Don't like seeing dead dolphins, because they are mammals and they're very intelligent, and they are biologically not too far. They're closer cousins to us than some other life. 3,000 dolphins found dead off the coast of Peru, or on the coast of Peru. Published, holy moly, this is older than I thought. This is from 2012. Because this is about when it started. It started, the fish kills, the giant kills of marine life. So here's just a visceral reaction here. Along just one stretch of coastline in Peru, and by the way, this is still happening because it hasn't completely stopped, and I'll get to how it hasn't. Along one stretch of coastline in Peru, more than 3,000 dead dolphins washed ashore in just 3 months, and a disturbing trend may only be escalating. With the latest discovery of 481 lifeless dolphins there, residents have begun to demand an explanation for the mysterious mass death. And as far as enlisted experts can tell, offshore oil exploration in the region is the most likely culprit. According to the report from Peru 21, local fishermen in Lambaresk, North Peru, have found first to notice the inexplicable rise in dead dolphins, averaging roughly 30 a day. While such mass orca strandings are not entirely uncommon, orca referring to whales and killer whales and so on, or fully understood, Peruvian biologist Carlos Yapin of the Scientific Organization for Conservation of Organic Animals says activity from petroleum companies in nearby waters is to blame for this instance. He believes that a controversial technique for detecting oil beneath the seabed using sonar or acoustic sensing is leading to the deaths of marine life in mass. Now, this isn't just oil exploration. It's all of the transports, all the tankers with their engines. There's all kinds of acoustic pollution that we, as well as, of course, actual regular pollution, plastic pollution, the plastic island, into the oceans. It's not good for it. Not good. Not good at all. Also, oil spills, like in the Gulf of Mexico. Not good. This story was even before that. Deep Water Horizon, as it's called. The oil companies use different frequencies of acoustic waves, and the effects produced by these bubbles are not plainly visible, but they generate effects later in the animals that can cause death by acoustic impact, not only in dolphins, but also seals and whales. In 2003, scientists from the Zoological Society of London discovered that the underwater sonar can lead to a formation of microscopic bubbles of nitrogen in the bloodstream and vital organs of aquatic mammals, inflicting the animals with the lethal condition known as the bends. Now, it was called the bends because when it first affected humans, which was in the case of when bridges were being built or any underwater construction, and their nitrogen levels would go up. And so when they resurfaced, or they resurfaced too quickly from the underground construction site, I think the first instance was the building of the Brooklyn Bridge, they would get really sick. And this was called the bends, because it was the Victorian era, and you give things just one word names. As of this writing, Peruvian, just as like PTSD was called the shakes. As of this writing, Peruvian authorities have yet to identify the company whose activities may be leading to this grim toll. According to the offshore magazine trade publication of Petroleum News, at least one entity, Houston-based oil company BPZ Energy, have been actively surveying the seabed along the coast of Peru since the beginning of the year. The people causing the death of our planet have names and addresses. Just saying. So to counter this a little bit, is a story from The Independent, a bit more recent. So this was caused, the death of mass die-off of marine life, caused by oil drilling and exploration. And so here in Norway, they are refusing to drill for billions of barrels of oil in the Arctic, leaving a whole industry surprised and disappointed. Oh, boo-hoo. I guess we'll all have to drive a little less. The move exposes rift in Norway's Labour Party as climate change competes with union concerns. Oh, business unions. Will you ever not be terrible? Written by Harry Cockburn. The largest party in Norway's parliament has delivered a significant blow to the country's huge oil industry, which is nationalized, by the way, after withdrawing support for explorative drilling off of the Lofoten Islands in the Arctic. which is considered a national wonder. So they're not stopping oil drilling, but they are not going to expand oil drilling, which is a good step. Just stop the bleeding. Eventually, you know, zero energy means you actually stop drilling at some point. And there's no year being put onto when do we stop drilling. It kind of needs to be next year. It needs to be yesterday. But here is at least the story of we're not going to drill more, which is not the case here in America. Still burning fossil fuels, still going to burn gas. And it's got to be drilled into Democrats' heads, apparently, that if we keep building gas pipelines and gas infrastructure, that we're still going to be burning fossil fuels for the, when I say foreseeable future, I mean past any goddamn deadline you want to put on when are we going to be all renewables. We're not going to get there. It's still only going to be 10%. Maybe it'll go up to 20%. The country currently pumps out over 1.6 billion barrels of oil a day from its offshore operations. Norway's largest oil producer, the state-controlled company, and by the way, state-controlled, in this case, does not mean people-controlled. It means state-controlled, which is kind of what is thought of when socialism is brought up, that state-controlled. Now, when an eco-socialist like me talks of nationalization or bringing a industry into public control, we are talking about democratizing it. Not making just putting government-appointed board in charge, but having, say, maybe an elected board, or making it a co-op, which is a federation of local concerns, municipalities, because it's on the local level that then you can actually say, like, where do we want our energy from? It is thought there that between 1 billion and 3 billion barrels of oil beneath the seabed is off of that archipelago. The area has already been kept off limits for years by a coalition government through various political deals. Quote, the whole industry is surprised and disappointed, says Carl Idrik Schlokrak Petersen, head of the Norwegian Oil and Gas Association, telling Bloomberg. It does not provide the predictability we depend on. Oh, looking a little precarious like the rest of us? Labor's opposition announced it by its deal. Jonas Gahr Støre, if I got that right, exposes a rift in the party as the leadership tries to reflect the population's rising environmental concerns, while also aiming to support workers' unions in the oil industry, which has been major backers of the party. So there's that argument that usually comes up against worker ownership, that they're still going to be very self-conceited, selfish, let's say. Not think about the common good, still just think about their jobs. I would point out this is worried about their jobs in a competitive marketplace. So when we talk about the common good, right, it can't just be in one business. It can't be in just one industry. It has to be everywhere. It has to be total, or at least it needs to be more mainstream and widespread to the point where we have an economy that isn't based on competition anymore. Competition of jobs, or rather scarcity mindset, the scarcity of jobs. It's like, well, if we don't build it, someone else will because we're competing, or there's just no other job I can do besides this thing that is killing all life on Earth. What do you want to do? I'm trying to feed my family over here. It creates imbalances in the policy discussions for an industry that's dependent on a long-term perspective. Well, at least somebody thinks long-term, huh? And we can't accept that, says Frode Iffelheim, the union's leader, telling the City Morning Herald. There's probably a lot of people in the industry who are wondering what labor actually stands for. Yeah, they're not standing for us workers, right? Yeah, just the rest of the country and the world. The move comes days after Norway's government gave the go-ahead on Friday for its $1 trillion oil fund, the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, to invest in renewable energy projects not listed on stock markets. Billions are expected to be spent on wind and solar power projects. It is the latest indication that wealth accumulated through fossil fuels is being redirected towards future profits in renewable energy. Greater numbers of industries and countries have begun fossil fuel divestment strategies, mostly through grassroots social movement. Join the movement for divestment. Citing future risks to their business and economic models. Go woke or go broke? Question mark. Last month, Norway's oil fund said it would no longer invest in 134 companies which explore for oil and gas, which would retain stakes in large oil firms, including, oh, but would retain large stakes in oil firms like BP and Shell, which have renewable energy divisions, which is greenwashing. So there's some good, there's some bad, or rather just continuing to be bad. So changing some things, but not everything. So I'm covering ecological news, just generally how dire it is, but not in trying to talk in a way that is not hopeless sounding. In fact, I want to, there's two kind of avenues. There's the nihilistic reaction, and then there's the anger at the system that produced this result. Because I watched a video from Peter Coughlin, the YouTuber, left-tuber. I recommend him. And he does important documentaries. They're just like long form videos. And this one's called, his latest is called Outrage. And general thesis, we're all mad at everything. Right? When you're mad at, when you see anger and toxicity on social media, it is our anger being turned on each other because we're always mad at everything because our system sucks. But what is needed is to direct that anger at the system. Not any one person, not even Trump. The system that produces Trump, the system that produces ecocide. The mass die-off of life on this planet. As I just said, a genocide of dolphins just took place. Well, not just, in 2012. Still kind of old news, but it's still happening, or rather it has happened. And was it news at all? Was it put on, was it a national story? Were memes made about the mass die-off of dolphins? I don't remember those. New reports suggest high likelihood of human civilization coming to an end starting in 2050. Now, this has the risk, the kind of like, you know, ecological collapse is coming. It's like, it has the risk to me of like those cultists who say the world's ending in 2012 or the world's ending at the stake, the Bible says so. One major difference is that this is actually based on science, rigorous study, peer reviewed process, which is democratic, where scientists hold each other accountable for what they say. Sometimes scientists come out and they're not being held accountable. Usually the article will not link to something peer-reviewed, it will just link to their own paper, and maybe there'll be rhetoric about how they're being ignored, how dare all the other scientific establishments and communities chafe at my hard-fought results, hard, you know, made results, but it should be taken with a grain of salt. This is from Vice Motherboard section by Nafis Ahmed, published just a few days ago. Climate change analysis that I'm citing here was written by a former fossil fuel executive, and it has been backed or supported by the former chief of Australia's military. A harrowing scenario analysis of how human civilization might collapse in coming decades due to climate change has been endorsed by a former Australian defense chief, senior Royal Navy commander. The analysis published by the Breakthrough National Center for Climate Restoration, this is a think tank in Melbourne, Australia. And by the way, something to say about Australia and why is this kind of dire report coming from Australia. The massive effects of climate change already kind of hitting us a little bit here in North America. But as far as the margins of not just society who are more greatly affected due to poverty and lack of resources, but the margins of the world, the northern and southern extremes of the world. So South Africa and Australia are literally in drought crisis, a crisis of drought, lack of water, forest fires, every kind of natural disaster related to high temperatures. So global warming, it is disastrous. It's just affecting the margins of the world first. So Australia and South Africa and Argentina, they're dealing with the crisis right now. And it is going to inch farther south, speaking from the North Pole, and farther north, coming from the South Pole, is going to encroach. And we got to be prepared for that, or prepared just for the reality that this is happening, that it's perhaps even too late to do anything about it. But if we're going to, say, not have a mass die-off of humans, then we can still prepare for that. So this study describes climate change as a, quote, near to mid-term existential threat to human civilization, and sets out a plausible scenario to where business as usual could lead over the next 30 years. And that includes growth of the renewables industry, because that's still an industrial modern industry that extracts resources, it creates value for stockholders, it works within a market. Because you can still have growth in renewables and fossil fuels. This was just pointed out in a video about, it was titled "I'm No Longer a Vegan" trademark, saying that more vegan products are being sold. And I did cover a story where, you know, it could be counted how many fewer animals were being slaughtered. But the growth of meat selling is also, there's also a growth of selling of meat. So there can be both growth of vegan products and, you know, because there's no zero-sum game, there's no limit to growth. Growth is the natural state of markets. Overproduction and then collapse from oversaturation. Like having too many ice cream shops in a neighborhood, eventually no one sells enough ice cream to make it. The paper argues that the potentially extremely serious outcomes of climate-related security threats are often far more probable than conventionally assumed, but almost impossible to quantify because they fall outside of human experience of the last 1,000 years. On our current trajectory, the report warns, we can't even imagine how bad it would be. And so I guess people just say, well, I'll pretend it won't exist. Just like our entire future doesn't exist. We can only imagine the past over again, over and over again. How are you liking those reboots? On our current trajectory, the report warns planetary and human systems are reaching a point of no return by mid-century, in which the prospect of a largely uninhabited Earth leads to a breakdown of nations and international order. Well, this has happened in human history before, but it usually means a lot of people starve to death. The only way to avoid the risks of this scenario is the report describes as akin to a scale of World War II emergency mobilization. Fancy that. That's exactly what the Green Party calls for. That's what our Green New Deal says. World War II emergency mobilization. But this time, focus on rapidly building out zero emissions industrial system to set and train the restoration for a safe climate. Scenario warns our current trajectory will lock us into 3 degrees of global heating. We should not go above 2. We're currently locked into a degree and a half, which in turn could trigger further amplifying feedbacks, unleashing further warming. It's already happening as far as the feedback loops. This would drive the accelerating collapse of key ecosystems, including the death of coral reef systems, already happening, mostly through the acidification of the oceans, which also occurs because it's warmer. The Amazon rainforest and other rainforests, as well as the Arctic. The results would be devastating. Some 1 billion people would be forced to attempt to relocate from unlivable conditions. 2 billion would face scarcity of water supplies. Agriculture would collapse in the subtropics. Food production would suffer dramatically. And by the way, a lot of our food comes from the subtropics. Probably more than you might understand. The internal cohesion of nation states like the U.S. and China, you know, world powers, would unravel. Even for 2 degrees Celsius of warming, more than 1 billion people may need to be relocated, and in high-end scenarios, the scale of destruction is beyond our capacity to model the high likelihood of human civilization coming to an end. By the way, human civilization doesn't refer to all humanity, it just refers to our current civilization. Like, once upon a time, there's this thing called Roman civilization. It collapsed through many, many causes. Just as American civilization, or Western civilization, or more accurately, modern civilization, will also collapse, a victim of its own success. The new policy briefing is written by David Spratt, a breakthrough research director, and Ian Dunlop, a former senior executive of Royal Dutch Shell, who previously chaired the Australian Coal Association. In the briefing forward, Australia has quite a lot of coal. In the briefing forward, retired Admiral Chris Barn, Barry, Chief of the Australian Defence Force, from 98 to 02, former chief. So he's been retired for quite a while, which I think that kind of distance is what allows him such clear-minded independence. Commends the paper for laying bare the unvarnished truth about the desperate situation of humans in our planet are in, painting a disturbing picture of the real possibility that human life on Earth may be on the way to extinction in the most horrible way. So there's that blackpilling there. Spratt told Motherboard that a key reason the risks are not understood is that much of the knowledge produced for policymakers is too conservative. Because the risks are now existential, a new approach to climate and security risk assessment is required using this scenario. Last October, Motherboard reported on scientific evidence that a UN summary report for government policymakers, you know, so-called leaders, whose findings were widely recognized as devastating, were in fact too optimistic. While the breakthrough scenario sets out some more high-end risk possibilities, it is often not possible to meaningfully qualify how probable they are. Let's see, their 2050 scenario illustrates how easy it could be to end up in an accelerating runaway climate scenario. This doesn't really go into the details of like how they studied, so take it with a grain of salt, I guess. But this is in line with a lot of other papers and analyses. And I think their analysis maybe stem from what is currently happening in Australia and what happens if it continues. What happens if it gets a little bit worse? I think that's what we're talking about here. Because things are already pretty bad. Everything sucks. And we're all mad at everything. We need to focus that anger instead of inward, which becomes depression or anxiety. Don't focus it outward at the nearest person to us. That's toxic behavior, and it's terrible, and I hate it. Focus it on the system. Don't even focus it on Trump and our leaders. I mean, they can be symbols of the system, certainly. They're, and the other people who benefit, the billionaires, millionaires, and the owners. But it's the ruling class. It's of the system. It's a pyramid. Gotta dismantle it. How do we do that? Let's talk about that. From EcoWatch. So here's something like, what does it mean to address the climate crisis? The scale of the problem is immense, overwhelming for an individual. Collective action can lighten that load. That is what we need to do. And if we're going to be collective, we need to think collectively, not just about what your footprint on the world is, what is your contribution going to be. Empty yourself of those expectations, as the Buddha would say. EcoWatch, this story is, drastically shorter work weeks are needed to fight climate crisis, study finds. This is a different kind of study from likely a different think tank. Drastically shorter work weeks are needed. So the scale of our response, collective or otherwise, though it does need to be collective, for sure, is, here's just an idea, that we do need, in fact, need to produce less. Producing, overproducing, is what is destroying the environment, in a way. So we need to produce less. Produce less value for owners, our bosses. Even if you're a small business owner, you need to think about how much are you really producing? How much energy do you need? Can it be zero energy? Written by Olivia Roseanne from May 23rd. If people in three European countries want to fight the climate crisis, they need to chill out more. That's the conclusion of a new study from the think tank Autonomy. I like that name. Their study found that the three countries they mentioned, Germany, the UK, and Sweden, all needed to drastically reduce their work weeks to fight climate change. General policy idea. The rapid pace of labor-saving technology, automation, brings into the focus the possibility of a shorter working week for all, if deployed properly, meaning for the common good, not for the profitable. Not for the sake of being profitable. Autonomy just means the ability to be free and make one's own decisions. The director, Will Strong, with an E on the end, The Guardian reported However, while automation shows that less work is technically possible, the urgent pressures on the environment and on our available carbon budget show that reducing the working week is in fact very much necessary. A vital contribution growing debate, says one tweet. The report found that if the economies of Germany, Sweden, and the UK maintain their current levels of carbon intensity and productivity, always rising, always needing to rise in capitalism, they would need to switch to a 6, 12, or 9-hour week, respectively, if they wanted to keep the rise of global temperature below the 2 degrees promised in the Paris Agreement. So think about that. Democrats that whine and chide about Trump pulling us out of the Paris Climate Accords, how valuable they were. Well, if they're going to mean anything, we need to take what it means to actually reduce our energy load, how much we're using, how much we have to dig up out of the ground, how much energy do we have to burn. The scale is immense, and thus the solution needs to be equally immense. And one way of doing something across the board is just thinking about how much the average person works, does things, uses energy. We welcome this attempt by autonomy to grapple with the very real changes society will need to make in order to live within the limits of the planet. The four-day week campaign said in a statement reported to The Independent, in addition to improve well-being, enhance gender equality, and increase productivity, addressing climate change is another compelling reason why we should all be working less. This is the group called the 4-Day Week Campaign. Just work one day less. Supporters of the idea linked it to calls in the U.S. and Europe for a Green New Deal and would decarbonize the economy while promoting equality and well-being. This new paper from Autonomy is a thought experiment that should give policymakers, activists, and campaigners more ballast to make the case that the Green New Deal is absolutely necessary. The link between working time and GHC, which is greenhouse gas emissions, have been proved by a number of studies. Work less, less emissions. See, it's the one way to know for sure. It's the one way to be sure. Strong also linked his report for calls for a Green New Deal. Becoming a green, sustainable society require a number of strategies, a shorter working week being one of them. This paper, says according to The Guardian, this paper and the other nascent research in the field should give us plenty of food for thought when we consider how urgent a Green New Deal is and what it should look like. What it should look like. Not just some corporate subsidies for building solar panels, but a complete redesign of our economy and how we live. From the New York Times. Here's a story about the electoral side of things. Our so-called leaders. Kind of want to ask you, dear listeners, good people, who represents you? Who represents you? So in Europe, they have a much better electoral system. Even whether or not we're going to debate electoralism is useful, especially in America. But in Europe, at least, it's easy to get on the ballot. It's proportional, so even if you only get 5%, you still get some people into the legislatures there. European Parliament just had elections in the last few weeks, and there are 5 big takeaways, particularly because the kind of declared winners, more or less, the people who kind of gained the most, were the Greens. The Greens kind of becoming, as one other article put it, a actual political force in Europe. And generally speaking, simply like more of a first party, not just a third party anymore, where they're on the side and they win a little bit, but they're actually like one of the main parties. Why is this happening? Because the old kind of duopoly or the binary of a kind of conservative center-right party and a center-left party isn't working anymore. It is in crisis because they utterly fail to address problems because the problems are caused by the very thing these parties have created. By Stephen Engelman, the most prominent takeaways from the results of the elections of the European Parliament are fragmentation and polarization. Oh, so bad, but I like it. Let's see. Fragmentation because traditional mainstream parties of the center right and center left lost seats to smaller, more passionate parties like the Greens and a variety of other populist groups. Polarization because populist and Eurosceptic parties increased their share of seats to 25%, up from the 20% of 5 years ago. It's a little bit of growth. The feared populist wave was more of a large ripple, but populists did very well in major countries where they are in power, like Italy, Hungary, and Poland. So in this context, when they say populists, they mean right-wingers, like neo-fasc. Because that's who's in power in those three countries, Italy, Hungary, Poland. Now, there are, not mentioned here in this article, are a number of countries where the kind of racist right-wing parties have been rebuffed. And I don't know if they lost seats, they certainly didn't gain more. Let's see, this was Denmark. They shifted a little bit leftward. In Spain, the Socialist Party, which, asterisk, the Socialist Party in Spain is the Social Democrat Party, which means they're just like Democrats. Same with Germany. I think the Greens did gain more seats. I think I covered that. That was the state elections there. But otherwise, in Germany, the Greens have gained, and the Conservative Party lost seats, rather. Same in Scandinavian countries. I mentioned Denmark. So there's kind of a, at least in Northern Europe, there's a swing kind of towards, a little bit towards the left. Not big. It's not like communists are charged, but it's better than before. It's not that, creep towards fascism, but you still have in Poland, Italy, Hungary, and a few other places, right-wingers are in control. Ukraine is kind of up in the air at the moment. Parliament is only directly elected institution within the 28-nation European Union. It is very undemocratic. Because this parliament here only advises the actual policymakers. It's very undemocratic. So the vote was seen by many as a test of Europe's growing populist movements and a referendum on the institution itself. With a markedly higher voter turnout compared to recent years, analysis said this groundswell reflected European shifting views of the relevance of the European Union. Here's what to know about the results. People were interested because there was high turnout. Fancy that. Highest turnout since 1994 and the first time since voting began in 1979. That turnout has not dropped from the previous election. It was a major jump from the 2014 one, where less than half participated. The results reflected a certain wake-up call, says Martin Schleiermacher, Secretary General of the European Commission, the executive arm of the bloc. They're the people that make the policy. The parliament just advises them. They don't make the policy. With Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, he said, people realize that if you don't engage in this European project, you can lose a lot. Meaning, more collective internationalist projects are a way of fighting the terrible people. Marginal success for populist candidates. The election has seen some as a gauge of the rising influence of populism in Europe, which has made marks in national elections. And this is maddening. The Times just says populists. They should say right-wingers. They're right-wingers. They're fascists. They're authoritarians. They're like, and they're calling them the populists. Yes, they're right-wingers that are using populist rhetoric. And left-wingers don't use populist rhetoric? Like the Greens don't use populist rhetoric? Why don't they call the Greens populist? They're not including the Greens and any other left-wing gains as populist, even though they're popular, or they could be popular. They're for the people, the common good. What the hell? New York Times. Ugh. But they cover these international, like, you know, parliamentary stuff because it's horse racing. And of course, the New York Times and other larger media institutions focus on horse racing. Voters rally behind anti-European Union parties. Oh, sorry, where? Yeah, a lot of horse trading here. The center kind of held, but it has to adapt. So, yeah, so this is the kind of conservative thing. So there was a different story that was more about, I'll have to refine it. Actually, I tried saving it last night, and of course, I got distracted. Curses social media. Curses Facebook with its distracting, like, thing of people doing things in my feed that I'm like either want to respond to positively because I want to love everything instead of hate everything, or at least I want to love things that deserve it. So the other story I'm going to reference here, not going to read all of it because these are too long. It's from Counterpunch. Recommend you check out Counterpunch. Tells the facts, names the names. And written by, I guess my new buddy, Howie Hawkins, running for president on the Green Party line. He just did an interview where he kind of made a mistake, so to speak. I think to some block of voters who will never vote green, though, which is kind of why it's like not strategically valuable, Howie is a quote-unquote Russiagator, you know, believes that Trump is a criminal and that there was crimes committed and thinks the evidence is clear. From another point of view, Russiagate is a red-baiting project of, you know, the ruling class, neoliberals, you know, corporate Dems, whatever kind of phrase you use to describe people you hate, like, people like Biden, the Clintons, the people who speak of social justice and workers and just do the opposite. They serve corporate interests. So Howie Weiss, yeah, so I'm just going to talk about, like, the thesis of this article, which is, what does the climate movement really mean what it says? Why the skepticism of the, quote, you know, trademark climate movement? Referring to kind of the sunrise movement, the ones doing the direct actions in the offices. It's very nice, but like they're fighting for their goals or just resolutions and half-baked Green New Deal proposals from AOC and other kind of just social democratic stuff. Social democrats are what's been in power in Europe, and it's all destabilized there. Not completely, of course. It's not like the welfare state's being gutted. But in some ways, actually in some places, it is. The recent victory I refer to in Denmark for the center-left is just that we're going to keep the social, the goods coming. That make Denmark the happiest country in the world. Don't you want to be happy? God damn. Okay. Let's see. So, quote from Howard Zinn. When a social movement adopts the compromises of legislators, it has forgotten its role, which is to push and challenge the politicians, not to fall in meekly behind them. Whatever politicians may do, let them first feel the full force of citizens who speak for what is right, not for what is winnable. So Howie starts, why do so many in the climate movement invoke climate science to demand a target of 350 parts per million carbon in the atmosphere, and then turn around and support legislation and candidates that fall very short of that demand? That's what is happening here in New York. A bill that says right in its text that its target is 450 may be enacted in the current legislative session that ends in the coming week with much of the support of the climate movement. The exceptions being farther left groups and the Green Party. If New York were a nation state, its $1.7 trillion GDP in 2018 made it the world's 10th largest economy, tied with Canada and ahead of Russia. New York is the world's premier financial media center. What New York does on climate policy is in the next month matters to the rest of the nation and the world. Climate scientists have told us for more than a decade that getting the carbon dioxide levels back to 350 is required to limit our temperature rise to 1 degree Celsius, not Fahrenheit. That would keep the planet within a safety zone for our current civilization. When it's higher than that, it will destabilize our civilization. Okay? No more yogurt, no more whatever the hell this is. But hey, we all hate it, right? We all hate everything now. So what are we fighting to save? Why are you working so hard to prop up a system to merely survive within it? When are we going to give it up? Like, let go of the way things are. Bill McKibben's 350.org, our frenemies in the Green Party, was founded in 2008 on the premise that we need to stop. We get it. that we need to get 100% clean energy by 2030. But now all the nonprofits, the environmental ones, the foundation-funded ones, have endorsed the legislation in New York that says the goal is 450, 2 degrees Celsius, and 100% by 2050. They will tell you half measures are the best we can get from the people now in office. That half of loaf is better than nothing. But half a parachute won't land you safely. The climate emergency we face is much more severe than the stronger storms and heat waves we are already experiencing, escalating at an accelerating rate as we approach 2050. The climate crisis means mass extinctions already occurring and collapsing land and ocean ecosystems, agricultural crises, food shortages, economic contraction, no longer just stagnation, which itself would be a disaster as far as money concerns. So with that, there needs to be a call for more. No more half-baked promises, no halfway measures. It's got to be 100% in 10 years. That's the climate science. That's the conservative climate science. And for that, revolution, baby. And I'll leave you that in the first hour. This has been Dan Platt with Three Lefts, live streaming currently on Facebook, Three Left Show, online on Patreon if you'd like to contribute to this project of mine. The website, threelefts.news, for full archive. That's pretty much all I got on there at the moment, but hey, I just want people to be able to access the content because we're also podcasted, but that can sometimes be limited on all of your podcast platforms. Thank you very much.
We'll be right back.
Okay, welcome back to the second hour of the Three Left Show. So this is I'm Dan Platt, your host for this leftist reading hour. This program covers news, issues, thoughts, and activism, anything of interest from a radical left perspective for the curious and the committed, promoting post-capitalism, present in the future, imagining a new future where we don't hate everything. Turn that anger we have today, not towards each other, not towards people on Facebook, but at the system itself. The show is for going in a different direction. And today I am covering the need for revolutionary change from the ecological side of things. That's the green in the three lefts. It's the red flag, the black flag, the green flag. Mix it all together. Those are also the colors of African nationalism, but my logo is flags, so they are separated into three distinct categories, which of course are all interrelated. But anyway, my background's architecture, and I went to school for it for 5 years. Studied urbanism and various things, and while I was doing that, that's kind of when I kind of got my radical streak. College is where you kind of develop your identity. I wanted to develop my worldview and kind of come to answer the questions, like, you know, to have solid beliefs that could carry me through the rest of my life. And certain things I figured out, and I'm kind of itching to kind of read old college papers on air, subject you to that. But I think it could be a bit of fun. I don't think people revisit old things they've written and kind of discuss where they've come from and how they've changed. I think that's a very instructive and healthy thing to do. Introspective. But it's where I kind of start figuring out that, like, there's a systemic problem, and just me being in a firm, working 50-hour weeks is not going to kind of make the world better. Which is why I went into architecture school. Make the world better, even if it's just one building, one project at a time, which is still, of course, present in my life. But not in the industry, not in the field that I trained for. Mostly because, as far as the market was concerned, they didn't need me, didn't want me. And at this point, I don't want them. Why? Because all the firms in Albany are attached to gentrification projects and large developments where one-bedroom apartments are $1,500 a month, which is double what they should be, what they normally are in my city. Okay, so I'm not talking about urbanism or the big issues, actually. Let's talk about individual buildings, building material. Certain stats you may not have heard is, it seems like every industry uses stats and cherry picks to some extent to make it seem like their industry is using the most energy or materials, and thus, if they do something, they're making a larger impact than others. Or rather, that anything they change to be more efficient or to use less energy is then like, look how great we are. Form of greenwashing, but there are some examples. So let's look at some things. Just generally, so like, we all live in buildings. Everything, you know, we live, we work, it's everywhere. So architects or the industry, building industry, it was like, you know, buildings account for this much energy use and this much of the embodied energy of our entire civilization. Everything you see around you, the parking lots, the stadiums, the infrastructure, it's massive, it's immense, it's huge. It's trillions of pounds of things. And some things are billed as more sustainable than others. Here is something that is not. Concrete. Concrete construction needs to be phased out. Now, a century ago, concrete was the future. Everything would be made of concrete, brutalist styles, modernist styles, not really grabbing anyone's attention long term. They were kind of fashions that then got outdated and unpopular. And now it's like a kind of online debate, discussion, or kind of back and forth of is brutalism actually like okay? Should it count as something worth saving? Now that some of these buildings are old enough, but they're still kind of falling apart because concrete has many drawbacks, including its embodied energy. Cement requires a lot of energy, both in the emissions and the pollution it creates. I mean, if you ever look up what a picture of a cement plant is and the ecological, the environmental effects Sometimes the Met plants are next to schools. Sometimes they're next in their place in neighborhoods. And they're poisoning everybody. Because they produce lead emissions and things like that. Mercury. But there's another reason to avoid concrete. Silica dust. This is written by Lloyd Alter. February of this year. Contractors are having trouble meeting a new safety standard. The concrete industry likes to say that concrete is recyclable at the end of its life. And recyclable is not the same as reusable. Although almost 80% of recycled concrete ends up as fill and road base. But there is another problem. As the UK Concrete Center notes, it is a strong stuff that lasts a long time. It is more than likely that a modern concrete building will come to an end of its useful life because no further use can be found for it, rather than because the concrete failed due to age. It's hard work taking it apart with big machines and jackhammers, and it creates a lot of dust. A new study has found that the levels of demolition and other crushing sites were way beyond legal limits, according to a Safety and Health magazine. Workers performing concrete chipping at substructure bridge repair sites had the highest level of respiratory crystalline silica exposure, meaning shit in their lungs, a time-weighted average of 527 milligrams per cubic meter in the air. According to Silica Safe, inhaling crystalline silica is sand, can lead to serious, sometimes fatal illnesses, including scoliosis, lung cancer, tuberculosis, and chronic obstructionary pulmonary disease. There are between 3,600 and 7,300 new cases of scoliosis every year in the U.S. Silica dust can be controlled with water, and workers can wear respirators and other protective gear. Silica Safe also recommends that workers change their clothes before bringing them home, showering before leaving a job site. Now, this is just about job sites and demolition of concrete in the context of recycling it and reusing it for some more purpose where it can be rubble and you can use it. But there's another big problem with concrete. As it erodes, that dust... Okay, I gotta back up. Okay, cement is made of pretty toxic materials. And in some cases, in a other form of reuse, the toxic material from steel making and burning of coal, you get things called coke. Not that kind of coke, but like coke from a blast furnace. And that stuff is reused in the making of cement. So then these mercury and lead and toxic materials are then cement, and then the cement is used with concrete, and we basically have entire cities made of materials that are, it's not like it's leaking it out into the air, but when it's turned into dust or it's eroded by water, it is getting into the ecosystem. It is getting into our drinking water. What drove this home was a lecture in school where this problem was mentioned, and it was a picture of Maybe it wasn't a lecture, but I saw this picture. It was very striking. It's basically a big block of cement that had fallen off from a building or had, maybe it was part of a bridge and the bridge had collapsed a long time ago. And it was in a stream. And the stream was kind of running over it. And it was basically kind of the caption or the article kind of, maybe it was just my own imagination that I'm imagining that this cancerous dust, the cancerous material, was being eroded and into the water, and the water was going into the general watershed. That is the dangers of these materials. It's been a very slow process phasing out volatile organic compounds in building materials and other consumer materials of all types. It's basically kind of the fumes that new plastic puts off. Usually known as new car smell, because see that those fumes are collected within the car, and then you open it, and then you get a full blast of it. Usually, it's still being like whether it's carpets, cabinetry, things made of plastic and made with VOC, you know, PVC piping. Sometimes, they're emitting these volatile organic compounds. Now, organic compounds themselves aren't dangerous, but these are volatile. When exposed to them, they make your cells volatile, aka cancer. So there's a need to go to sustainable, rather non-toxic materials. Now, metal is kind of pretty much non-toxic, but aluminum and other such things, very high embodied energy, meaning it takes a lot of energy to make it. Got to melt metal down. I mean, that's not easy. But see, like, notice the title of the article was Another Reason to Avoid Concrete. Another reason. This didn't even go into all the reasons why you shouldn't use concrete. Now, there are some innovations like aircrete and these concrete substitutes and the like that are starting to kind of, they're in the material science pipeline. Because concrete being man-made stone, so that you don't have to quarry it, you know, your marble and stone slabs and transport it, you can just make your stone material on site. We still want to be able to do that, to continue the building styles that we have, or the mechanized, the modern, the industrial scale of building that we do. Another example, though, if we want to be less toxic, more sustainable, not more, actual freaking sustainable, it's got to be small. We got to think small. Or if we scale up the infrastructure or whatever, it needs to be a lot of smaller things that are done more incrementally, actually, but gradually, a process of unfolding that generates life instead of taking it away. But here are two examples, very fine grain, of how to address some of these issues. The first is from offgridquest.com. And it's called Making Wood Last with Fire, Not Paint, a Japanese technique. So usually to make wood last, you put stains on it, primers, staining wood, chemically treating it. Chemically treating with what? Industrial chemicals. So definitely not all natural, and definitely not good for us in the long term. Shoshojiban, or yakushuji, is an ancient Japanese exterior siding technique that preserves wood by charring it with fire. Traditionally, shuji wood, also called Japanese cedar, was used. The process involves charring the wood, cooling it, then cleaning it, and then finishing it with a natural oil. That's lots of good pictures here. Today, this technique is an environmentally friendly way to preserve timber and paradoxically make it fire resistant. Because when something's already burned, it's you have basically a layer that isn't combustible because it's already combusted. Chemical preservatives, paints, and retardants are therefore unnecessary. In addition to exterior uses, the popular technique is now found in interior rooms, furniture, as well as artwork. Lots of great pictures here. It is still a popular tradition in Okayama Prefecture in Japan. Nowadays, designers and architects use other species of wood, like a western red cedar, Douglas fir, cypress pine, and oak. The process involves charring the wood, cooling it, cleaning it, and finishing it with a natural oil. I just read that. Although time-consuming, the final product is not only gorgeous, rich black, with its rich silvery finish, the charred wood also resists fire, rot, insects, and can last up to 80 years. Now compare that to industrial, chemically treated stains, finishes. They last 20, 30 years tops. Got to think about, when it comes to thinking sustainably, you need to think about the lifespan of something. At the very least, it needs to last your lifespan, or it should. And I think that is, yes, that's the article. It's mostly pictures showing off just how interesting it looks. And in this nice, this house that is completely black. So, to finish up the kind of theme, thought, track of talking about sustainable materials, so I just talked about charring wood to preserve it instead of using chemical finishes and the like, and paint, lead or otherwise. Takes more time to char wood. It's like other Japanese crafts. It's a lot of attention, a deep craft and putting yourself into what you're doing, It's a skill that takes a lot of time to master things. It's slower, but generally the results can't be argued with. They last longer. They don't kill you. Don't give you cancer. So next one is in the UK and less traditional, but maybe it is. Studio Bark, that is what they're called, bark with like tree bark, builds a fully biodegradable and recyclable cork building. The Cork Studio, a garden building made almost entirely out of cork, has been constructed by Studio Bark as a building prototype that can be completely recycled, reused, or very importantly, composted. To challenge the architecture industry's dependence on unhealthy single-use materials, London-based architect Studio Bark sought to demonstrate how one eco-friendly material could be used to form an entire building envelope. Now, the envelope in the biz is referring to the exterior of a building, because a house is not just walls made of brick, wood, or concrete. It is also a vapor barrier to keep moisture out. It is siding to then protect the barrier, the vapor barrier and the wall. And insulation to insulate sound and energy exchange. That's it, energy exchange. Been a while. Still have the textbooks. As a society, we waste a huge amount of time, energy, and resources in decorating, redecorating, demolishing, and rebuilding parts of our buildings using unhealthy single-use materials. Now, why is this the case? I think in a capitalist mindset, it's because we want to change things constantly. We want new things, but isn't demand and scarcity being created? Yes, it is. Think of all the industries, the jobs. Think of the jobs, or rather think of all the bosses that are created and business owners. For all the different businesses, from start to finish, rather it's a never-ending cycle of, as they say, decorating, redecorating, demolishing, rebuilding. You need firms for every step of that. Every step. So many businesses, so many jobs, so much growth, opportunity. But for what? Waste creates waste and destroys life on the planet. I can't stress. That's why when I talk about ecological issues, I always include some story about how our civilization is destroying everything. Slowly. May take a whole century, but it's starting to happen. The wildfires, the mudslides, the droughts, it's just starting, just starting. And it can happen a lot faster, as human history shows, that the decline can be long, but once ecological disaster sets in, the collapse takes a decade. You know, where the government actually fails and things like that. And whether you stockpiled guns and food or not, or you have rebuilt an actual village society that can sustain itself on its own. Going off on a tangent. But Cork Studio shows that there can be an alternative. There needs to be alternatives. We need to implement them yesterday. Following a series of experiments that tested water, fire, and degradation resistance, Studio Bark chose to work with cork, a strong, durable material that is sustainably harvested directly from the bark of the cork oak tree. In case you didn't know where cork comes from, it is a tree product, which means agroforestry is in, baby. All of the elements of this solid cork building can be disassembled at the end of their useful life, and the individual components are either fully biodegradable or recyclable. Cork Studio also was constructed using disregarded granules from a wine cork manufacturer. The granules were turned into solid blocks through a heating process, which triggers them to expand and release a natural resin that binds them together. Following this, the blocks were cut into desired slab sizes and joined on site. There is no cladding, rain screen, cavity, plaster, or paint, ground floor slab, or foundation, just a single thickness of cork, which carries out all the necessary function of structure, waterproofing, acoustic, fire, air tightness, and aesthetics. Chosen for its high thermal property, the low-density cork is used for the floor slabs, even. Combined with the material's waterproof qualities, this neglected the need for a concrete screed, which is usually a default for house building, and it didn't need a damp-proof membrane. Usually, like, to keep water from coming up through your house, through the ground, you need all kinds of layers. The same type of cork has been used to create a flat roof, supported with a series of timber joists that help stiffen its structure. So they did use some wood to, you know, keep these from being blown over. Now, I question the flat roof. Flat roofs are a modernist thing, and flat roofs, you never want a flat roof. So I'm not sure where... But there's this kind of quip where, like, the modernist masterpieces of the great architects, when they designed a house, they did it with a flat roof. You know, these are all plaster-covered, white buildings, concrete. The roofs would leak. The roofs would always leak, and the masterpieces would need to be renovated later. Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water, Corbusier's block buildings, modernist masterpieces, the roofs would leak. To provide better resistance against lateral loads like wind, the walls of the cork studio are constructed using higher density slabs that are fitted together with insulation screws. Throughout the studio, and the studio refers to this small building they made, like a studio apartment. Every surface has a natural finish without any toxic varnishes, meaning each part can be easily recycled in the building's life. A sycamore tree that was already growing on site has been incorporated into the building. Natural design process there. As the lightness of the structure allowed studio bark to build on top of its roots without damaging the tree. Respecting other life. Fancy that. At ceiling level, it is enclosed in a rubber gasket which allows water to trickle down the tree so it can self-water while keeping out heavy rain. The cork studio has... So they use some rubber, too. But rubber is also a tree product, and also biodegradable. Cork Studio has recyclable polycarbonate windows, plywood door, internal sliding shutters, which act as additional buffer against temperature, while controlling light. Put those on the windows, also known as blinds. Studio Bark built the envelope for under 500 pounds a square meter, and claimed the structure could easily build by two people in 2 days, and fitted out and inhabited within 7. Cork Studio was not Studio Bark's first sustainable prototype. In 2017, it developed a microhome as part of an initiative called The Shed Project, which aims to provide an alternative to property guardianship, where people pay very little rent to live in abandoned buildings. I think I will research that and cover that in a future episode. The prototype allows easy assembly in just 1 day using a mallet and a drill, and can also be disassembled, transported to another location, and rebuilt. Because it really is just a bunch of walls, pieces that are put together. Which is what makes it special compared to other homes. Like I said, it's just one slab for the floor. Instead of, usually with a house, you need a layer of gravel to drain water away from the structure, and then you have a layer of to keep water out, and then another layer that is the structure, usually a concrete slab, and then you have all those layers of subfloor on top of that. Because a lot of, not heat, but in the wintertime, the ground is always a 55 degrees, which is how geothermal works. So in the summertime, you're using 55 degree water to kind of cool things down. And then in the wintertime, you're using 55 degree water to get your water level up to 55, and then you only need to heat it 20 degrees more. What's the next story? I think I have just enough time to talk about something that is less ecological related, but still something that didn't fit in with the next episode I will do next week. I'll have a different theme, and this kind of straddles it. So, the abortion ban. Hot topic of the last few weeks. Always seems to come up every once a year where Republicans pass abortion bans to either be challenged. Maybe they know that it won't work out and won't be legal, but they still want to use it for fundraising and stuff like that. brownie points for their constituents. I mean, after all, it's not like they're delivering any economic security to them. A point made by a Marxist in South Carolina that I watched was that if you haven't seen the certain stat that southern states require more government assistance, not just the state itself, but everyone in them, you know, food stamp rates are higher, all kinds of assistance is needed. They, as far as taxes are concerned, they take more from the Fed than they get, than they give via taxes. They are taker states. They're the real takers, these red staters, these ignorant, Bible-thumping enemies of liberalism. But who are they really? They are exploited and oppressed workers is what they are. Because as this Marxist said, that it is not that South Carolina does not produce value or not productive. It is just that everything they produce, all the value they produce, is scooped up by the megacorps and taken out of state. Because, see, unless megacorp is based in your state, like in New York, many of the megacorps are based here. So we have a more than a trillion and a half economy, about the size of Russia's. But really, is it because New Yorkers are just so goddamn great? No, it's more that capital lives here. And even then, we have legislators that talk of how our budget can't grow and how we can't spend too much. Otherwise, those companies don't have to be based in New York. They could be based in South Carolina. But otherwise, point is that workers are producing value. It's just that they don't get to keep it. And that is socialist precept number one when it comes to unionization and common ownership and the need to have radical economic change, a.k.a. economic democracy. Economic democracy, that is eco-socialism. But anyway, I was talking about abortion, wasn't I? Now I'm pro-abortion here, personally, meaning that it should be accessible, available, and it's a healthcare right, just like any other type of healthcare, just like any other type of birth control. I don't moralize about it, except that if you take it away from people, then it's like taking away cancer treatments. It's like taking away any other type of health care that is valuable, that saves lives, that is a net positive. But I'm just a het man, but I am in solidarity with the women who require it. In Poland, they were putting out a ban, just like Alabama and some other southern states, Louisiana's too. But I want to draw a contrast in the reactions. But here in America, the reaction is to run around with your heads on fire and say just how terrible it is, and it all seems very ineffectual and impotent. What are you going to do about it? You know, what are you going to do about it, liberals? What are you going to do about it, Democrats? You seem to, year in, year out, for 15 years or so since this trend started, seem to be losing ground in the fight for abortion rights. Now, here in New York, we passed something like it, but it's still like in the weeds. But in Poland, they were going to pass one because, as stated before, they have a quote-unquote populist government, as New York Times put it, meaning neo-fasc, very right-wing, super-nationalist. And of course, that means clamping down on women's rights and clamping down on queer rights and just generally being trash people. Rather toxic. So this is put out by, this is from Yahoo News. It's just like something that was shared. But the title is, a Polish Parliament Rejects Abortion Ban After Mass Protests. In Warsaw, Poland's parliament on Thursday rejected an abortion ban after women staged massive nationwide protests in the devoutly Catholic nation, where the law is already among the most restrictive in Europe. Right-wing and liberal parliamentarians, lawmakers, in the 450-member lower house joined forces to reject the bill with 18 abstentions. The vote came after tens of thousands of black-clad women protested across Poland on Monday as solidarity demonstrations sprang up in European capitals like Berlin, London, and Paris. Home to 38 million people, Poland sees less than 2,000 legal abortions a year. But women's groups estimate that another 100,000 or 150,000 procedures are performed illegally. You do not get rid of demand for a human right by criminalizing it. Jacek Sulkowski, leader of the governing right-wing Law and Justice Party, told Parliament before the vote that his group would always support protecting the right to life, just not the lives of women. But he said the proponents of the ban were not going about it, protecting the right to life in the best way. Ooh, he had to walk back. Perhaps direct action gets the goods? So where's that women's march, huh? Where's that women's march? You know, they can respond and march and rally against Trump during the Trump inauguration and then have fewer numbers each year after. But when an actual women's issue comes up, are they in the streets? Are they organizing another mass demo? Are they showing the power of women? Where's the women's march? Where's the women's march? There should be a women's march. As soon as this bill was put out and made national story, I should be seeing updates. I should be seeing invites to the next women's march. The women's march at the end of June. Maybe it'll take a few weeks to prepare for it. But instead of being a big show, a performance, maybe it should actually be an action. Maybe it should actually be a strike. Women's strike. This is what happens in other countries when women's issues are brought up, when they are attacked, when laws are brought up. Women go on strike. They don't go to work. They don't do the housekeeping. They say, enough is enough. I am going to care about this. I'm going to take the day off. I'm going to work less. Not just because it may actually save the planet, but at the very least so I can have health care. To think selfishly about it. Where the hell was I talking about? This is the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt. Leftist Reading Hour, wrapping up this week. And speaking of which, from New Statesman America. New Statesman is a pretty nice magazine. I listened to their podcast for a little bit. They're UK-based, but this is New Statesman America. They're invading. Anyway, the story is from a section, The Stagers, by Will. It's called Human Supremacism. Why are animal rights activists still the orphans of the left? So this is definitely very much ecologically related. I am a social ecologist. That means that it's just a general belief that to fight oppression everywhere, anywhere, we need to fight oppression everywhere. And not to kind of be touchy-feely about, like, plants have feelings kind of way, but we oppress nature first and foremost. By exploiting it, by saying that this land is ours, that it can be owned by a person or conglomerate for the purposes of making profit and recycling things, just putting back what we take. By taking more than we put back into natural processes, all right, I'm speaking very generally here about natural processes. So, fighting dehumanization is a central challenge for the left. In Blair French's 1998 novel, The Ticking Tenure Clock, the central character, a junior political science professor, is struggling to finish a book on the orphans of the left. Animal rights activists. According to French, animal rights activists in the 90s saw themselves as part of a larger progressive family that sought to protect the vulnerable against exploitation by the powerful. Yet they also felt disowned by other members of the family. Sometimes, aside, this is because, like, oh, if you care about animals more than people. Well, that's never the case. It's more about because we care about other people, we also care about animals. 20 years later, the situation remains unchanged. Proponents of various social justice movements routinely express support for each other. Feminists often show support for Black Lives Matter, immigrants for gays, gays for immigrants. But animal rights groups remain outside of this circle of solidarity. As Amy Dowell notes, none of the major feminist orgs in the U.S. devotes a committee or internet space or even has any policies dealing with animal rights issues. Indeed, as John Solabastu indicates, the left, with few exceptions, has historically viewed human violence towards other beings with indifference. This indifference has been a source of frustration and puzzlement to many animal rights activists. Part of the explanation is simple self-interest and inertia. The use of animals as instruments in our society makes possible a steady flow of pleasures, often very intimate pleasures relating to what we eat and wear, what are central to people's identity. So even when people realize that the treatment of animals in our society is morally suspect or egregious, they employ various techniques of moral disengagement, cognitive dissonance, and the like. There is, however, something deeper than self-interest and moral disengagement at work in the left's resistance to animal rights. Embracing animal rights would challenge not only people's identities and lifestyle, but also a central philosophical pillar of left politics known as just general humanism, putting humans first. And this comes from, and it makes the kind of points out that in past socialist struggles, leftist struggles, there was always a, I am not an animal, I am a man, right? So you should stop treating me like nature and start treating me as an equal. But what if it was more, we treat nature equally to us, thus everything is then made equal, everything is risen up to the standard of the normal, quote unquote. On this humanistic account, respect for human dignity consists precisely in treating humans better than animals. Conversely, now, I want to state that there are forms of humanism that lead to animal rights and social ecology. That is the type of humanism I employ. So maybe it's not correct or accurate to call it humanism anymore. I guess that's why I call it social ecology, that we are part of ecology, we are animals, we are part of the circle of life too. We should act like it. So thus, when we elevate humans above animals and nature, it becomes human supremacism. And if you think white supremacism is bad, or any other type of supremacy of one group over another, why should humans be above other groups? Sounds ridiculous, I suppose, but let's expand our sense of empathy, since we actually do have empathy for animals, pets, and so on. There's a little joke about how, like, one day in the future, a child will ask his grandfather, Grandpa, is it true that we kept animal slaves? And the grandpa will go, ah, we called them pets, and they were lucky to be our pets. Sometimes they were treated even better than other people. Won't that be quaint? Similarly, E-Trade commercials. When I watched TV, live TV, which is very rare, but when I do, sometimes there's an E-Trade commercial that this is a stock trading like company or app, and their ads are the worst. They basically say, like, don't be mad at the rich or the system. Join it. Buy in. Sell out. And then there was, like, one where it's, like, it was showing all these the pets of the wealthy. And it was, like, these pets live better than you do. Don't be mad. Start stock trading. You know where you can stick it. Okay. Human supremacism, of course, is not unique to the left. It can be found across the political spectrum with deep roots in monotheistic tradition. They use Judeo-Christian. It's monotheistic, not Judeo-Christian. They're different things.
Okay.
As a Jew. In many ways, it is simply a secular version of the longstanding religious idea that humans were uniquely created in God's image. Yet the left's commitment to humanism has been strengthened by the central role of dehumanization that has been played in the fight for social justice. So, in the process of granting equal rights to other marginalized humans, there is the mistake of dehumanizing the rest of life on Earth to make it less relatable to us and less worthy of protection. And I think it was most strained in the 60s, where you had the civil rights movement and a burgeoning, still in its infancy, environmentalist movement. And unfortunately, because of this cross, not even, I guess it was a matter of strategy or rhetoric, that these were silos. They were separated and divide and conquer, when really they needed to be one movement. And I think we're starting to get there, where we start talking about racial discrimination in pollution, and that pollution is a social justice issue. And more black groups and other kinds of social justice movements are incorporating rhetoric, ecological or environmentalist rhetoric sometimes, or at least in saying that they are one struggle, which is good. So I think this is starting to get away, but veganism and animal rights are still kind of marginalized. They're not included. And even, like, say, in the Green Party platform, it wasn't adopted, but there was a plank proposed of banning zoos. There's other ways of educating the public on animals and showing people animals. I think large safaris or large, well, basically nature preserves with paths and so on. That is better than animals in cages, because no matter how quote-unquote spacious or comfortable a zoo is, it's still an animal in a cage. And I hate zoos, personally, but I think there's many reasonable reasons for not liking zoos. And I think it just makes objects out of even primates, who are very so close to us. That's torturous for them. They don't live well. Let's see. Indeed, many of the great injustices of the 20th century involved dehumanizing people, treating Jews, blacks, immigrants, gays, queer, those with disabilities, and other outgroups as less than fully human. And a growing body of social science evidence confirms that many groups in society continue to be dehumanized. So maybe the solution is to then humanize everything else. Not in the literal sense that they are not seen as members of humanity, but rather in a sense that they are seen as less likely to possess distinctly human qualities that distinguish us from animals. Specifically, outgroups today are seen as driven by basic instincts we share with animals, say pleasure or fear, but as less likely to display these human feelings such as remorse or gratitude. Super predators. This leads to discrimination, prejudice, the like. But it also renders outgroups vulnerable to violence, since it is assumed that, like animals, they need to be controlled through force. These young black teens need to be brought to heel. And of course, I'm not just Clinton bashing here. Republicans speak in terms of punishment, fear, intimidation in every way, whether it's the drug war, sex education, anything that's a culture war battleground, but really just a society itself. That crimes need to be punished. And that's apparently what makes us better than animals. Caging, beating, raping. This belief that human supremacism helps fight dehumanization underpins many of the strategic choices of the left since World War II. African American civil rights movements made a deliberate decision in the 50s to invest in sanctifying the species line as a resource to fight dehumanizing racism. American society was accused of treating black people as if they were animals, and most social justice movements from the 60s on followed the same humanist strategy, including movements seeking to defend women's rights, gay rights, and even the disabled. This is why animal rights activists have remained orphans of the left. The paradigmatic argument for animal rights depends on emphasizing the continuities between humans and animals. Continuity, not just we're the same. It is not easy to see how this chasm can be overcome, but there is now growing interest in bridging it. One reason is that supremacism is difficult to defend in our post-Darwin world. Darwin's theory of evolution showed that humans and other animals are continuous with respect to our interests and capacities. If humans share ancestry with other primates, and if we share 98.8% with chimps of our DNA, then whatever makes human lives valuable or worthy of respect almost certainly is with the lives of other animals. And if you can see a picture of a dying, starving orangutan in Borneo because of palm tree farming and not feel something, then we need to talk, I guess. But perhaps the most important reason for building bridges is that human supremacism may not be even an effective strategy for fighting this dehumanization in the first place. There is growing evidence that shows that a belief in human supremacy species hierarchy itself aggravates rather than alleviates the problem. The more people believe that humans are superior to other animals, the more likely they are to dehumanize immigrants, women, and other minorities. Yes, any hierarchy is poison to equality or egalitarian values. Interestingly, in the last minute here, the links between species hierarchy and dehumanization is causal, not correlational. For instance, when participants in studies are given a newspaper story reporting on evidence for a human superiority over animals, the outcome is an expression of greater prejudice against other human outgroups. By contrast, those who are given a newspaper story reporting on evidence that animals are continuous with humans, with the possession of valued traits and emotions, become more likely to accord equality to human outgroups. In short, reducing the status divide between humans and animals helps reduce prejudice in all other categories. It helps strengthen the belief in equality among other humans. This suggests that human supremacism is not only unnecessary as a strategy, but is in fact counterproductive. It was a mistake in the 50s. It's a mistake today. And social ecology is all about that, to fight oppression anywhere. And this was their message too. Gotta fight it everywhere. And if you can't look at factory farms and say that's oppression, or if you can't look at deforestation and dead great apes starving to death and say that's wrong, then where are we going? Will is a Canada research chair of political philosophy. He is the author of Multicultural Citizenship, and he co-wrote with Sue Donaldson, Zoopolis, A Political Theory of Animal Rights. Thank you for joining me on the show. I'm going to finish up now. This has been Three Lefts on WCAA LP, The Voice. I have a voice in Albany. Links to the show can be found, all sources are found on when I post this episode as a podcast on Patreon and Facebook and Twitter. That is where I list all of the sources. A full archive of the show is found at threelefts.news, nothing else. I've been your host, Dan Platt, and we pierce the heavens with our drills. You have a great weekend and the beginning of an interesting summer.